It's March 15th, 2024, the Ides of March, and this is the Room Now podcast, and I'm Dr. Jack Cush with Room Now. The Ides of March, you know what that means? It's actually an unlucky day for those of you who are superstitious. Actually, it refers back to a Shakespeare play where they basically go over the demise of Caesar. So March 15th is thought to be the day that Caesar was assassinated. So Friday, the Ides of March, if your name is Caesar, don't leave the house. If you're superstitious, don't leave the house. The rest of you, go on as you will. Today on the podcast, we got a lot of stuff, but a lot of lupus stuff. We're going to talk about lupus pregnancy, platelets, vaccinations, and hemodialysis. But first, let's begin with infections, serious and not serious. A Dutch study of almost 600 patients who were taking biologics looked at the rate of non-serious infections. Actually, I published a paper with this with Catherine Dow many moons ago, and it shows, not surprisingly from the clinical trials, non-serious infections are the most common adverse event. That includes mostly upper respiratory infections, could include UTIs, but these are nonsensical infections, and in RA, they happen in half the patients in a year. In this study, they showed the relative importance of non-serious to serious infections, serious being hospitalizable infections, where the SIE rate was 1.3 per 100 patient years. That's about right for biologics these days. But the non-serious infection rate was 77. That would make it 60-70 times more common. And again, on par with what's been reported in the past. In their study, in this Dutch population, upper respiratory tracts were the most common. And more importantly, that they tend to recur. And they tend to recur over time at a very stable rate. So what does this mean to you? One, if you get a non-serious infection in a patient on a biologic, don't stop the biologic. The non-serious infection is going to be gone long before the half-life of the drug takes effect. Second, if you have recurrent non-serious infections, I wouldn't avoid biologics or aggressive therapies. I might work up the patient as to why they're having recurrent non-serious infections. Let's talk about serious infections. A Japanese study of over 670 patients. These are patients who are mainly on TNF inhibitors, and they use a lot of tocilizumab in Japan. They showed the rate of NTMs, non-tuberculous mycobacterial infections, used to be called atypical mycobacterial infections. NTM, the rate was 1.6%. And this was in people who had never had an NTM infection and was after the use of the biologics. Of those 1.6, that was 9 cases out of 672. 2 were disseminated, 2 died. NTM patients did have a higher mortality compared to those who didn't have NTM or mortality risk. And NTM patients who had that infection were more likely to be on higher dose of steroids, 17 versus 3 milligrams per day of prednisone equivalents. You know, again, NTM is more common than TB. TB, as a complication of biologic therapy, is driven by what? TNF inhibition, not T-cell, not B-cell, not Jack, not IL-6, yes, it has happened with those other biologics, but it's TNF that makes granulomas and stabilizes granulomas and keeps infection under control. When you inhibit TNF, granulomas break down, and then you get reactivation of TB. Same thing happens for NTM bugs, right? And that would include MAC and, you know, MCANSASSI, M-fortuitum. So what you need to know about NTM is that they mostly have lung presentations. They tend to be younger people, maybe a little bit more male than female. But yes, steroids are a factor, and TNF inhibitors are a factor. The good news is that you can treat them, and that problem will go away, but you probably should take them off the TNF inhibitor. Another serious infection was covered this week because I listened to a great Grand Rounds by famed GI specialist, Dr. Byron Cryer, who is the chief of internal medicine and gastroenterologist who I worked with at Southwestern for many years Byron's like upper GI, peptic ulcer disease, NSAID complications. Fabulous lecture. He talked about H. pylori and a few facts I put up. One, H. pylori is actually acquired during childhood in most of us. I always thought that I got H. pylori and got it treated and did so much better, but I didn't have developed dyspepsia until I was in my 30s or late 30s. And then I got treated and never taken another drug since then for dyspepsia. But anyway, it starts in childhood. It remains dormant until activated under many different stressors, sometimes being age-related or acid-related. It can be associated with stomach ulcers and cancer, but usually is not a cause of dyspepsia. And I found that surprising. The other thing, other tidbit that I learned from him is that while there are many tests, you know, there's a breath test, there's a biopsy test, we often do serologic tests. And while they're okay in an initial diagnosis, after someone has been treated and for eradication, you still may have a positive serology in up to 25%. So repeat serologic testing in patients previously treated for H. pylori is probably not going to be beneficial. There was an interesting study of the safety of ixekizumab, the IL-17 inhibitor. This was basically a compilation study of over 22,000 patient years of exposure from 26 different RCTs where ixekizumab was used in adults with either psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, radiographic spa and non-radiographic spa. And the main common side effect, as we said earlier, with non-serious infections is nasopharyngitis. And again, those numbers did not increase over time, remained stable. The number of people who discontinued the IL-17 inhibitor for adverse events was 3 to 5 per 100 patient years. ISRs, injection site reactions, about 6 to 11 per 100 patient years. Candida rates and IBD rates were very, very low, as you would expect, based on your experience, based on what's in the package insert. Interestingly, the IBD experience in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis is about 0.1 or 0.2 per 100 patient years, about 1 in 1,000, maybe 2 in 1,000, but goes up 7-8-fold to 0.8 per 100 patient years in AXSpA. And that's also reflected in all the IL-17 literature that finding IBD could be uncovering pre-existing IBD, could be new IBD, but the numbers are, and the risk is a little bit higher. The numbers are low, but they are higher in patients with ankylosing spondylitis. So let's get into lupus. A Japanese study of almost 100 patients with lupus pregnancy, they looked at those, and about 60% of them were in remission at conception. Lupus patients in remission had fewer adverse pregnancy outcomes compared to those with activity. And it looks like it's like 73% less adverse pregnancy outcomes that include miscarriage and all that sort of thing. There, you could not predict adverse pregnancy outcomes based on serologies, but you could predict adverse pregnancy outcomes if the pregnant lupus patient was using 7.5 or more of steroids per day. With steroids, there's almost a threefold increased risk. A Chinese study looked at the interesting association between lupus and thrombocytopenia. I think the number was less than 60,000 in that study. They had 350 patients, and they found that 55% of those patients had antiphospholipid antibodies. Interesting. And patients with antiphospholipid antibodies tended to have lower platelets at baseline than those without. Actually, it was 61 versus 76. So it must have been less than 100,000 to get into the study. If you had antiphospholipid antibodies and you were thrombocytopenic with lupus, you had a much greater risk of relapse. It looks like about a 20% higher rate, and that was significant, and significantly lower chance of achieving complete response rate. So it is a sort of marker for a more severe patient with lupus. Obviously, you know, one of the four presentations of the antiphospholipid syndrome could be chronic refractory thrombocytopenia. I don't know if that's exactly what was being studied here because they didn't give that kind of detail, but there is this association, and seeing thrombocytopenia, I mean, I would always check antiphospholipid antibodies at one point or another in all patients with lupus when I'm doing serologic profiling. But certainly if they develop thrombocytopenia, that would make a great deal of sense to recheck that. there is this folkloric, sometimes thought to be true, adage that lupus patients who go on hemodialysis go into remission, and many of them don't need to be treated further for lupus. I know from my own experience that this is sometimes true, but not always true. Yet I found a study this week that looked at a cohort of 137 patients with lupus who were starting hemodialysis. At the start of hemodialysis, 67% were not taking lupus therapies. So that's kind of encouraging. More importantly, the longer they stayed on hemodialysis, that 67% went up to 76% at 1 year, or 83% at 3 years, where they were not taking lupus immunosuppression. Nonetheless, lupus can still flare in patients on hemodialysis. They found that the flares were most common in the first year of hemodialysis, that most of the flares were thought to be minor flares that weren't going to change lupus treatment, but that 12% had severe flares that did change the need for further lupus management. So this data sort of supports the notion that this happens. But don't believe for a minute that because your lupus patient's on hemodialysis, that it's going to be peachy keen and all rosy for them. By the way, hemodialysis patients, lupus patients on hemodialysis had higher rates of cardiovascular events. They had higher rates of hospitalizations for infectious events. So they're going to have a lot of other complications related to hemodialysis and related to the chronicity of lupus and that past immune disorder. But don't think that they're not going to need have no need for further lupus therapy and whatnot. I have to tell you, the craziest thing I've ever seen, I've seen this three times in my career, is someone managing lupus inappropriately and stopping their lupus therapies because they were in renal failure, creatinines 3, 4, whatever, and they figured if they stopped the lupus therapies, their kidneys would fry and they would go on hemodialysis and the lupus would be better and easier to control. I'm telling you, that's a special kind of stupid. Those people did not do well. So never stop lupus therapy in an effort to get the patient faster to hemodialysis. But it is still somewhat true that they will do better as a group. And lastly, this is a negative study, but I think it's important to state that lupus patients who are vaccinated are not at higher risk. Vaccinations do not increase the risk of getting lupus. This is a vaccination study of 17 studies, 45 million people, follow-up at least of 2 years. All vaccinations did not increase the risk. Hepatitis B vaccination, the odds ratio was 2, but the confidence intervals were 1 to 4, so it's not significant. Same for HPV, same for influenza, and same for COVID. The confidence intervals on all those cross over 1, making them all non-significant. So again, there's a significant number of people who are worried about this idea that vaccinations cause immune disease, and what better prototype for that would be lupus. Well, this sort of meta-analysis says that that's just not true. Great data comes out of the DanBio registry. I have two reports this week from the DanBio registry. One is a study that looks at incident cancers in the RA DanBio Danish registry. This is looking at almost 22,000 treatment starts using biologics, and basically they showed that in their 96,000 patient years of exposure, there were 1,423 cancers with no overall increased risk of cancer when in the patients exposed to either tocilizumab, sarilumab, abatacept, or rituximab, and that's in comparison to TNF inhibitors. But then they showed some subtle differences. And for all four of those drugs, the hazard ratios range from 0.7 to 1.1, not significant. There was no difference between abatacept and TNF inhibitors, not significant. Nor in the risk of hematologic malignancies when looking at those treated with rituximab or TNF inhibitors. So the idea that, you know, rituximab might be better or whatever, that's not borne out by this data. So again, I think many of you are very concerned about the cancer story when you're using biologics, but Don't blame it on the biologic. Blame it on RA. Uncontrolled RA. RA bad enough to get you on a biologic, whether it's abatacept, tocilizumab, rituximab, TNF inhibitor, it doesn't really matter. It is bad enough disease that you're going to be at higher risk for many different kinds of malignancies. And that's what you should worry about. And again, I'll reiterate, as I've said before many times, the ACR guidelines on treatment say that if a patient has a solid tumor and develops a cancer, treat that patient as if they didn't have the cancer, meaning there's no reason to stop your biologic and change to something else, right? Now, the guidelines get a little murky when it comes to hematologic malignancies or melanoma. I don't. If you got melanoma, especially in melanoma in situ, or a lymphoma, I still keep them on their biologic. I treat the arthritis. Let the cancer guy treat the cancer if that's an issue. You may have heard of the Jackpot study. This is a sub-study that's reported this week on patients who are starting on either a JAK inhibitor, a TNF inhibitor, or a non-TNF inhibitor, or what we'll call an other MOA drug. And they looked specifically at discontinuations for adverse events as a measure of what drug might be safer or better tolerated. And basically, they showed that there's no difference between drug discontinuations in Jackpot between TNF inhibitors or JAKs. But they did show that there were more drug discontinuations for other MOAs compared to JAKs. Hazard ratio 1.1, that was significant. They showed that TNF inhibitors had less discontinuations compared to tofacitinib, and that was significant. But TNF inhibitors had more discontinuations than baricitinib. That makes no sense. Maybe the last point might be one that is worth considering. And in their, again, 46,000 plus 47,000 almost new drug starts, if the patients were over the age of 65 with a cardiovascular risk, they did find that TNF inhibitors were less likely to be discontinued compared to a JAK, somewhat mirroring the data from the oral surveillance study. I think that's interesting. JAK inhibitors in the news, sort of a meta-analysis about JAK inhibitors as potentially useful therapy in juvenile dermatomyositis, not always easy to treat, certainly no trials on this, but a meta-analysis of 26 reports and 195 patients, which means that it was like three or four people in each report, that when those patients were treated with JAK inhibitors and followed for a median of 5 years, the median age of these juvenile DM patients was 5 years, they had a good success. Improvement in 90% with tofacitinib, 70% with ruxolitinib, and 93% with baricitinib. So again, most of the data does come from tofacitinib use in this population. But I certainly would like to see, and there are some clinical trials and drugs being developed actually with JAK inhibitors that are currently not yet FDA approved using dermatomyositis as an indication. I think the studies are being done in adults, not kids. We should have studies done nonetheless in kids. Lastly, another important myositis subject is that of inclusion body myositis. I posted for you a nice review article of this debilitating myopathy that usually occurs in adults over the age of 50. The review says that most patients present as asymmetric, painless weakness, often with distal weakness, often with atrophy of finger flexors or quadriceps, and many of these people will also have dysphagia. The sad, shocking part is that many are wheelchair bound within a dozen years or so. I didn't know that. I only had one patient myself. Inclusion body myositis, you need a high index of suspicion. And that should be an older patient with distal weakness, especially if they're not responding to things that usually have worked for you in the past in treating idiopathic inflammatory myopathy. So it's worth taking a look at that and beefing up. I think that as a rheumatologist, if you haven't diagnosed one inclusion body myositis, you probably missed two. And I don't know those epidemiologic numbers to be certain, But I do fear that we often miss this by not considering it. The last report is a reprise from last week about depression and RA. This is an important Dan Bio study that was presented at last year's ACR, I think, or ULAR, that said that there's a five-fold increase of death if an RA patient has incident depression. Last week, we made it the title of the podcast, and we talked about the Korean study with a 66% increased risk in a study of almost 38,000 patients who had depression compared to five times that amount who didn't have depression. And this week's is a similar 1-to-5 cohort comparison. And from the Dan Bio Registry, 11,000 RA patients compared to 55,000 non-RA comparators. And when depression was in play, all-cause mortality had a 5.5 increased rate in the first 2 years. This is shocking. Overall, in the follow-up period, which I think was 3 to 5 years, I think it was 5 years, that it was still elevated with a threefold increased risk for all-cause mortality. Again, just as I previously made a big call for reviewing your knowledge base on inclusion body myositis, I think you should review how are you handling the identification and management of depression in your rheumatoid population. It's a gigantic problem. Certainly death's a big problem, but beyond that, they never respond. They have poor response rates. Their outcomes short of death, their morbidity and their multimorbidity is astronomical. Identifying those patients will be a tremendous service to them and certainly help your management of their RA in the future. That's it for the podcast. Go to the website, check out these citations and more. We'll be back next week with more hot stuff in rheumatology. Take care of yourself.